Welcome to Pop Unlock. I'm Landry Ayers.
And I'm Natalie Dalzicki. John Carpenter has had his fair share of hits and misses, but only one of his films makes our skin crawl with paranoia about whether or not those around us are still, in fact, human. Here to discuss Carpenter's 1982 sci-fi horror cult classic, The Thing, is senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Julian Sanchez.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And columnist for the New York Times, Jamel Bowie.
Hello.
Jamel, I thought I would start a question off posited at you since it's your first time on the show with us. You wrote a rather succinct review of The Thing on Letterboxd in its entirety. I thought I would read it for everyone so they understood. It reads, "Oh, hey, look, it's the most nightmarish thing I have ever seen." Would you care to elaborate on
that? Sure, you even got my exact intonation. That's like more or less how I said it in my head. So I had somehow never seen The Thing before then. I thought I had, but I think I had memories of playing The Thing video game back from the early 2000s, if you remember that, sort of a survival horror game. There were a bunch of those. There was an Aliens one. It was a whole thing. But I had never seen the movie, and so sort of apropos of nothing at the beginning of this year, I decided I would watch every single John Carpenter film. And at this point, I've mostly done that. I have one that I have not finished, but I watched them all in kind of chronological order. And so I came to The Thing, and I just wasn't anticipating how horrifying The Thing actually looked in all of its various forms and permutations. And especially, I think that thought came into my head specifically during the blood testing scene where Palmer turns into his head splits open and he turns into a monster who tries to eat Windows. And at that moment, I was like, this is genuinely nightmarish. I hope to never see this again. Of course, I rewatched it last night, so that was not really the case, but. The creature designs, and this is, people have said this a million times, but the creature designs in that movie are just something else entirely. So that's what that review was sort of referring to.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting kind of contrast, too, because in a sense, right, this is a sort of a slow burn psychological horror. I mean, it's not a slasher fic. The force of it is in this sort of tension about... the blood is spoiled, but who had the keys? And they're trying to puzzle out who among them could be the thing and whether it's safe to be alone with someone else. And that's where all the tension is. And I think, it didn't do that well on first release. It wasn't reviewed that well. I mean, in part because, you've got this slow burn, simmering psychological horror, and then you've got this absolutely revolting, body horror transformations, that sort of punctuate that. There's relatively few of those scenes, but they're really memorable, and I think maybe that sort of was so overpowering and to a lot of people so repellent that it almost just sort of obscures that most of the horror in the movie is not about that.
I've always found it interesting that this movie is thought of as primarily a horror movie because to me it has so much in common with the paranoia thrillers of just a couple years earlier in the 70s. Like that to me is its more immediate lineage. And not for nothing, The Thing from Another World, the first movie based off of this short story, is very much of I think it comes out in 1953 and 1954. It is very much of a piece with sort of the Red Scare inspired anti-communist paranoia science fiction movies of the age. And I think that The Thing, it's just in the DNA of the property, but then that really comes out, I think, in John Carpenter's rendering of the story. And when you place it next to something like The Parallax View, Alan J. Pakula's film, which I think came out in 78 or 79, there's a lot of similarities just in that sense of ever-present dread of not knowing who you can trust and not really trusting even the very fabric of the society you've built.
Well, it's interesting, Julian, that also that you brought up like this difference between like a slasher horror film and like what Jamel was saying, like this kind of like psychological thriller horror. Because we before this podcast, we covered Candyman, which is like couldn't be different in terms of like a horror in the within the horror genre. And I was thinking the same thing, that like the type of horror in both these movies is very different and very distinct, obviously made in different time periods. But I think too, this movie kind of situates itself. Landry and I, right before this, were talking about how this year was like crazy for movies. Like this The Thing came out the same day as Blade Runner, and also E.T. came out like 2 or 3 weeks before it. So it kind of situates itself very interestingly between like those types of films. E.T. has aliens specifically, but I think it's interesting to look at it as like some people actually don't consider it a horror film. They more consider it like a psychological thriller with some like gory scenes, right? Or some like some jump scenes, but not necessarily horror. But I actually think it's scarier than a slasher film because it's more like, I feel like it gets to more at human nature and like your understanding of like self and what is self than like slasher films do. But maybe that's just my personal preference on what scares me or what's more nightmarish, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you know, genre classifications are always, you know, sort of a bit of a mug's game. I would, you know, I would call it a horror film. I think a movie where dogs are consumed into a kind of multi-headed snarling blob thing with flailing tentacles is just from that scene alone has already sort of established itself as horror. And, you know, a lot of horror movies are to some extent right about the tension of when the killer is going to strike. But yeah, I think this is doing a lot of more interesting stuff than that. I mean, you can make the same argument as, like, say a movie like Cube, which has sort of horror elements, but doesn't quite, you know, track the genre conventions. So it's sci-fi, and, you know, and these are always sort of rough and ready characterizations that you know, it's not worth hanging a whole lot on. I do think it's interesting, actually, you mentioned the this was released pretty close to Steven Spielberg's Alien, which that would be interesting to Steven Spielberg's E.T., which of course at the time was massively more successful. This was sort of a flop at the time, but I feel like now, at least among sort of movie buffs, E.T. is kind of regarded as schmaltzy and not very interesting, and The Thing has become a kind of cult classic.
Yeah, it's very much, I feel like, the sort of admiration for, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, who, you know, struggled during his day. And obviously a lot of the film was inspired by the sort of cosmic horror stories that he wrote about. You can see similarities in the initial reaction to the odd, unrecognizable but somewhat alluring nature of those stories that with time we grow to recognize, and that's sort of reflected in the you know, first reactions to what the people at the base look at when they see The Thing. Is, you know, they start to really, after being initially scared by it, trying to, you know, parse where the line between who is, you know, between themselves and the monsters in the face of these careless eldritch abomination type creatures that are just like completely unlike anything that we've ever perceived before, which is obviously a huge inspiration to Carpenter's sort of spiritual trilogy of films that The Thing started with, this and then Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness, which it is in and of itself a play on At the Mountains of Madness, a story that he wrote.
And the setting for this story, the setting for The Thing, of course, is based on the Campbell short story, but Campbell himself was probably inspired by At the Mountains of Madness. This is another story by Lovecraft that is set in the Antarctic and is essentially about an expedition discovering alien horrors frozen beneath the ice. And so I think for kind of horror fans now, you know, looking at this, you would very naturally think of that Lovecraft present. I'm curious if Jamel hasn't, having seen the other two in this sort of Lovecraftian trilogy, probably more recently than I have, certainly.
I actually have never seen either of them.
Well.
So I'd be very curious to hear about the other two.
No, I will. First of all, I would highly recommend both Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness. Of the two, I think Prince of Darkness is probably the stronger film. Even if it has the sillier concept, which is, you know, what if Satan were goo? but I really love it. And In the Mouth of Madness is a little more conventional. And I don't think as interesting, but Sam Neill, who stars in it, gives a really incredible performance. But so, you know, all three movies do deal with this idea of more or less incomprehensible evil. The other two movies, it's more explicitly evil. I think one of the interesting things about The Thing is that obviously for the human characters, The Thing is a terrifying monster, but The Thing itself is just an organism. It's just trying to do its own thing, so to speak. And it is difficult to attribute moral motivation to it. It is not malicious. It simply wants to assimilate because that is its biological drive. And when I think about how unpopular this movie was, and it's worth, I think, if you can find reviews of this movie, it's worth reading them, because people, it wasn't just that this flopped, it's that people hated it. They thought it was really, really not, they thought it was trash. And, you know, part of me wonders if that reaction to the film reflects, it's a kind of horror, it's a kind of take that is at, that was at odds with, I think, where American culture was at the time. The idea that there are these, you know, not just fundamentally foreign, but incomprehensible entities out there for which we cannot actually control, right? So much of the movie is the characters, and specifically the science, you know, Wilford Brimley's character, being driven mad by the recognition that there's no way to control this thing other than everyone killing themselves and isolating themselves. And this, a movie where the villain is on some level unknowable and uncontrollable and cannot be stopped except through, you know, the ultimate self-sacrifice. And even then, maybe not even then, probably just rubs sort of mourning in America, you know, America wrong in terms of the kind of message it's put out. When the country has this sort of reinvigorated sense of optimism and power, a movie, you know, whom you know, all the main characters are American, they're an American base, a movie that essentially says that your sense of power is an illusion and there are things far older and far more powerful than really you can even imagine. And one of my favorite shots in the movie is when they're exploring the crashed craft in the ice floe. And it's a cool shot because it's very obviously this combination of a constructed set in the location, but then a matte painting, and sort of the way it's shot creates this, both they can shoot the actors, you know, climbing down and interacting with physical objects, but then the way it's shot because of the matte painting creates this sense of immense and otherworldly scale. It makes sense to me that people would just find that really off-putting. In the same way that I think there are a lot of films that hit basically at the wrong cultural moment and people find that off-putting. Whereas I think if this exact movie came out today, right, and let's imagine that the effects, which hold up very well, you know, the effects are updated for, you know, 2021. If this exact movie came out today, I think people would lose their minds. They'd absolutely love it. Because I think sort of the national mood is more tuned to the kind of, you know, fear and paranoia this is trying to communicate.
You brought up watching this film today versus the context that it was in when it was originally released in 1982, specifically because of another scene that you brought up at the beginning, Jamel, which is the blood testing scene. And I hadn't thought about this while I was watching it until that scene when I believe it's Windows is the first person that they test, and he cuts his thumb with the bloody knife and, you know, puts it into the cultured dish. And then they all use this same knife, I believe, to cut their, you know, their skin and, you know, produce something for a test. And this movie came out in 1982. The AIDS epidemic was just beginning to really, really ramp up. I think a week before this was released, there was the first study that suggested, with any type of conclusivity, that there was probably some sort of sexually transmissive virus that was causing the AIDS epidemic. But it was still very, very unclear at this point what the transmission method was. You know, was it blood? Was it saliva? Could you get it from a handshake? And we know, of course, over, you know, time, we learned so much about this and that a lot of these fears were, you know, really overblown and people were being very paranoid. But it is really interesting the way that this scene in particular is placed. And looking at the film today in a sort of context of a fear of contagion of COVID, I don't initially think of the movie about something acting in a virus-like fashion, but it really does sort of function in getting from that body horror genre to something much more like a virus. So does that make you view what the film is saying any differently than what you might have originally?
I mean, for me, not so much, because I think, I mean, when I try to think about big picture ideas this movie has, I think, and I don't think this is a stretch, but also, you know, the characters themselves aren't, you know, making, you know, ideological statements really at any point. But yeah, the movie, this isolated compound, constructed society. And the movie is sort of asking, you know, how strong are the bounds of that society? You know, when something like this emerges, can, you know, we act cooperatively to deal with it? Because I think it's very clear, on my second watch, this was clear, that had everyone just sort of taken a breath and worked constructively together, they might have been able to contain the thing before it really took over. But the immediate paranoia and fear, you know, dissolves those bonds, whatever they were, between the men, and renders them easy pickings for the thing. And that, I think, that kind of perspective, that message, whatever you want to call it, can apply to so many different situations, right? Can apply to so many different occurrences, not just pandemics, but, you know, as I said, the first movie comes out sort of in the midst of the Red Scare, and that, I think, you know, it applies there as well.
There's that great bit of sort of foreshadowing where they go and visit the ruined camp of the Norwegians, from which that originally sort of unearthed the thing, and they find the place sort of charred and gutted. And it is, at least in retrospect, I think, fairly clear that what's happened here is not just that the thing has done all this, but that they've turned on each other, that they've killed each other, and that a lot of these charred corpses were probably not things at all. They were humans who got torched as they became paranoid and killed each other. In reference to what Jamel said earlier about the sort of the utter alienness and unknowability of the thing's motives, I think one of the really interesting choices that they make in the film is that, and I think in the short story, the thing is actually telepathic and mind reading, which is, I think, left out of this, except I guess to the extent that it gains knowledge about the people that it assimilates, is that this is obviously, right, an extremely intelligent organism. It starts building a spaceship out of spare helicopter parts. So this is, you know, this is not just some slavering beast. This is a very sophisticated intelligence. It is capable of human speech. Obviously, it speaks as a person when mimicking people. But the thing as a thing never speaks. I mean, it basically just sort of roars. Or makes these kind of terrifying noises. It never, you know, cajoles or threatens or taunts or explains. It never, once it's revealed as a thing, speaks to the party. It only does that as a kind of, it only uses language as part of its disguise, even though obviously it's capable of that, which, you know, helps render those motives more opaque. And you do sort of wonder, is it because in its natural state. It doesn't think in these linguistic terms. This is just a kind of coloration that it puts on as a disguise. It's not close to kind of how its own real natural processes work. Or is it just that it sees us as such a kind of lower form that that it doesn't even occur to it that the dialogue with us would be a relevant strategy.
And I think, Julian, even if it's, for instance, if it did talk, that would be like an inherently different film, right? And I think the point of us like not knowing kind of what it is and like that element of like it adds an extra layer of like us not being able to control the thing or understand it or even like begin to start like studying it. And ultimately, when I was watching it most recently, I think this is maybe the third time I've seen it, but it's been quite some time since I watched it last. But to me, I felt like I could relate to this type of isolation. Because like isolation within the last like 2 years, you know, we've been isolating and distancing ourselves and all that kind of stuff. And that's like a big part of this film is, and I think I could almost relate to like how after being so isolated, you become paranoid, right? So I think that made it a little bit more accessible to like today's audience, like we were talking about. But I also think that the setting and like the landscape and the visual elements really play in to that idea of like isolation and leading and how that can lead to paranoia. And I was wondering how how both of you thought that the setting or the landscape really enhances the film. Like, what if it wasn't in Antarctica? Would it be an inherently different film if it was, you know, dropped in New York at a lab?
Yeah, I mean, if it were in New York in a lab, if it were, I mean, the stakes of the movie would weirdly, I mean, they'd be kind of the same, but it would have to have an entirely different vibe. I feel like a movie that were set in a city would have to be by definition more of an action movie for reasons I can't fully articulate, but just there'd be the sense of immediacy you would feel as a viewer, right? Like, you know, Wilford Brimley's character in the movie realizes that if this thing can get out, it'll infect the world in short order, and that would still be an important plot point, but it would be the main point of the film, right? So that's what the film would be about in terms of its narrative. Like, how do we stop this thing from getting out? Whereas an isolated Antarctic base, in addition to the setting, I think allowing for a slower burn, right? Sort of like the fact that the film isn't very long, but sort of moves at this slow, steady pace. Even the camera movements are slow and deliberate. That is sort of like a visual, almost a visual representation, but it flows from the setting itself, the slowness and the stillness of Alaska, which is where it was shot. Why I think that, I mean, the setting it works for all sorts of reasons, but I think because Carpenter wanted to make a slower burn of a movie, I don't think you could have placed it anywhere else but somewhere remote, right? So you could imagine this movie in a desert. You can imagine it sort of like in a remote forest. But I don't think it really would work in this. It'd have to be a different kind of movie if you put it in a populated area.
Well, I mean, it would be spreading, right, in a sense, so quickly. The fact that it's remote in a way kind of gives them the luxury of, kind of trying to puzzle out who the thing is and who the thing isn't, and maybe hoping that they can, they can get rid of the remaining things before the time when the rescue craft would come to take them away. Although you do wonder, you know, is there a point when you know, maybe earlier on when they should have said, look, we just need to kill everyone. we all need to take one for the team here, and send the whole place up in flames, which ultimately is what happens. Because we've been talking about the horrifying mood, that there are just like a lot of great little jokes that I kind of enjoy in this movie.
Yeah.
And they're usually kind of visual jokes that you kind of have to think about a little bit to catch them, because but they don't want to break the mood. But there's just wonderful little bits of sort of funny business. I like that it's technically like an Alaskan Husky or something, but that the first sort of vector for the thing is, you know, essentially something that looks like a wolf, because the whole thing is about a wolf in sheep's clothing scenario. And of course, you wonder, well, what is, you know, what is so horrifying that it wears a wolf's clothing to make it seem acceptable? One of the very first scenes where we see the thing in this wolf dog form stalking the hallways, Stevie Wonder's Superstition is playing. And the lyric that you hear at the exact moment the wolf starts stalking down the hall is "good things in your past." And it's not, you know, they don't punch it too hard, but it's that's clearly intentional. I also like that at one point they're showing the folks, the scientists watching Let's Make a Deal on the television there. You wonder how they get the broadcast, but I suppose it's probably videotapes or something. But they're watching a clip of Let's Make a Deal that's all about, well, there are three doors, and which of these doors has the prize? And you know, the contestant is sitting there fretting over which door is the right door to pick. They all look the same, but one of them has something different behind it. So it's, you know, very small kind of background jokes that I enjoy that don't kind of interfere with the flow of the horror, but on a kind of second or third watch, you kind of go, oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah. And especially it's Palmer who's watching Let's Make a Deal, and it's on videotape, and he stops it and is like, oh, I know how this one ends. And he switches it to another episode. And Palmer actually drops one of my favorite lines that I think is really funny when he's rolling a joint while they're all sitting around trying to figure out what's going on. And he drops Chariots of the Gods, a reference to this, you know, famous pseudoscience book that sort of is one of the foundational texts, you could say, about this sort of ancient astronauts theory that has given, you know, History Channel so much fodder to play with over the years. And I laughed at it in the moment, and I was like, oh, of course, that, you know, perfectly encapsulates the, like, kind of guy that he is. I was like, they picked the perfect reference there. But then looking back, you know, talking about it right now, when I was watching it, I didn't realize that the thing came from space. I knew that it had been in the ice for a long time, but it didn't click with me in that moment that Palmer was actually, like, kind of right there in that moment. So there's a sort of funny irony that sort of also carries on when you think about how this was a big influence on a lot of other media, so much so that there's an entire X-Files episode that basically takes the entire conceit of it and even a bunch of plot points and simply puts it in an X-Files episode where Mulder and Scully go to an Antarctic base like that as well. I was also curious, did anybody else, I don't know if this was just me, but did anyone else immediately watch The Thing and think of just playing Mafia or Werewolf or Among Us?
Yeah. That's, Among
I mean,
us. Which is
that's
obviously
all it
inspired
is.
Inspired by The Thing. Yeah,
yeah, it's just like a social deduction game. But it's interesting because, like, you wrote in the document that we were taking notes in before this, Julian, like, there are times when you think, oh, The Thing is, you know, assimilating into these people and, you know, sort of jumping from host to host in order to achieve some sort of goal, even if it's like a base level need of survival. But also there's sometimes when you think, do the people who are assimilated know that they are the thing, which kind of complicates the notion of a social deduction game of an informed minority as opposed to an uninformed majority and trying to parse out who is who.
Yeah, I mean, there are variants of Werewolf, depending on how you're playing, where your role can change during the night, maybe unbeknownst to you. So you can become, in some of these variants, you can actually become a werewolf without knowing it, which makes the strategy much more complicated. Then you have to figure out whether, you know, maybe your card was switched or whether someone is pretending your card was switched, so you're the werewolf and you don't know it. But yeah, there's a couple points where I think it's implied that there is some uncertainty on the part of the people themselves about whether they are things. The in the blood testing scene, when Windows' blood gets tested, he sort of breathes this very visible sigh of relief, like, oh, like he wasn't sure entirely what the result was going to be. And you even, you know, I mean, earlier on, Norris, who turns out to be a thing. So first he's like offered, they don't really trust Gary with the gun anymore because he had the key to the blood and he might've tampered with it. And, so he kind of agrees to give up the, you know, his gun and let someone else take charge. And so they offer it to Norris, who is at this point, presumably a thing. And he says, oh, no, I don't think I'm up to it. And maybe that's like a strategic thing. Like, oh, I don't know if I can keep the disguise up through that much scrutiny. But later he's, you know, he's sort of feeling some kind of internal pains, and grimacing, in moments when he's alone. And you kind of look at that and think in retrospect, you know, was he being taken over or had he been taken over but was not yet conscious of it? Which it adds a kind of second layer of horror, right? The initial horror is, I don't know who I can trust, which of these people is the thing. But then kind of the second one is, I don't even know if I can trust myself. Have I become, would I know it if I had become a thing? Which in some sense, right, I think that dovetails with the, right, sort of extreme body horror that we get in this film. I think body horror, right, at some level is about the disconnect between, I don't know, kind of, I guess, the pure self, right, the Cartesian mind that we might, even if we, you know, intellectually don't think that's what we are, but we kind of perceive ourselves as these, you know, I am the abstract person, the mind, and these kind of meat cages that we're locked into, that sometimes, you know, betray us by, you know, developing tumors and otherwise breaking down in ways that do not match our conscious will. So the kind of extreme body horror of your neck gets elongated, your head turns into this horrible spider thing, and your torso opens up and becomes a kind of ravening jawed mouth, is, you know, it works very nicely with this idea of the horror of not being sure that this physical suit you're wearing is going to betray you, is acting in a way that comports with the desires of the person within.
That's a really great observation, and I think it gets to why the prequel that came out in 2011, there's a thing prequel that was released, doesn't really quite work as well, because I think the writers and filmmakers of that movie thought in terms of scares, sort of what's scary about this, and they thought in terms of what's scary is a big, you know, monster trying to get you. But that's not really what's frightening about this movie at all. And so to take that approach, it's sort of like missing the point in a big way. I think it's interesting, right, that sort of to the extent that the thing survives as a property, there is the aforementioned video game, there's a sequel, but there are tabletop games based on the thing. And going back to the, you know, the earlier point about, you know, werewolf or mafia or whatnot, I think this absolutely does, like, if you were going to, any way you would try to revive it, that the key has to be thinking in terms of, you know, this paranoia and this isolation in this sense of unknowability, like not only of the people around you, but of yourself as well. Right. Like, I think they're always talking about remaking this movie. And I think there's a remake currently in development. But if I were going to remake this movie, I might change the setting only in ways to sort of enhance that sense of isolation. Right. You know, in an undersea base, set this movie in space. Right. Like, so, in the future.
You'd have like a whole universe. It's like the thing goes to the desert. Right. The thing goes under the sea.
I mean, I think the right format for this is a game. I mean, there's a reason mm-hmm. Among Us, which is, you know, was a runaway hit, yeah. Maybe especially during the pandemic when we're all with it. In fact, you know, watching the movie, kind of having played Among Us, which is, right, as for those who haven't played it, it's a game with a similar premise. As you're on a space station or some other isolated environment, and Some among you are essentially alien murderers who are trying to get the others alone as they accomplish various tasks so they can kill them. I remember there's a scene where Red McCready does a little bit of game theory and says, okay, look, I know some of you must still be human because if the thing had taken over everyone, I would just be dead. And so right, they're actually trying to reason backwards very much the way you do in the game Among Us from, all right, who's been alone together? If the thing had been alone with this person, then that person would also be assimilated. And so can we kind of reason backwards so strategically to try and figure out who might or might not still be a thing? I think a game is the right mode for this because, you know, more effective even than watching other people go through this kind of paranoid process is engaging in it yourself and kind of wondering if, hey, is the person I'm in this room with going to turn around and kill me horribly? And Among Us does this with a kind of, very cartoony, kind of almost cute aesthetic. But, you know, imagine kind of a game like Among Us, but with high-end graphics of the sort of John Carpenter style, where it's not just a cutesy, you know,
you're not a version of Pac-Man running around.
Yeah. But the other player literally turns into this kind of monster thing. I think that would be absolutely horrifying. And, you know, maybe the only reason they haven't done it is that I'm not sure how long I could stand to play it.
Yeah. As fun as a VR game would be like that, I would probably play one round and then be like, nope, that's good enough. That was my $60. Well, the idea of, you know, sort of being aware of the people around you specifically made me, as that game suggests, made me realize I did not know that Mafia was originally developed by a professor at Moscow State University. And so sort of came to fruition and was developed through student groups, I think in the late portion of the Soviet Union. So there's sort of this like lingering tale of this surveillance system. And so watching this movie through a sort of, you know, panoptic lens, you know, using that sort of terminology was something that I didn't think about, but might lend itself a little bit more to sort of developing why some of these characters acted in the way they did.
Although, I mean, in a sense, that would resolve the tension to some extent. Although maybe not. For the same reason you have to take away the cell phones in every horror
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
So they can't just call the SWAT team in. It is dependent to some extent on sort of limits of surveillance technology within the base that you are left with this question. And although you could imagine, right, talking about how to update this, if you were to do a remake or a sequel today, you might imagine something based around the idea of, look, we know that, you know, aliens are among us. And so how do they adapt to the technology and how much kind of technology are we willing to embrace to surveil our fellow organisms in an effort to suss out who might and might not be a thing. Maybe I think, you know, like the right twist there is, of course, that maybe there are no things and we've just done this to ourselves.
The monster was us all along.
So we have to talk about the ending.
Yeah,
right?
I was just about to ask because yes, I saw yeah. Joanne, you wrote yeah. down, what if this is a happy ending? Care to elaborate?
I mean, so I realize, right, the natural and probably correct read on this ending is that this is sort of a bleak, somewhat nihilistic, terrifyingly ambiguous ending as Childs and McCready just sit there passing a bottle of scotch back and forth, wondering which of them is the thing. But on the other hand, right, I mean, there's been sort of tension between these two the entire film. So even up to the point where we know Childs and McCready are both, or at least, you know, let's assume the test is accurate and all that. But the fact the movie's presented us, I think we're supposed to understand that at least up to a certain point of the movie, both of these characters are human and they've kind of been at each other's throats anyway, sort of almost irrespective of knowing that. And so this is the first one where they can actually sit down and share a drink, right? They're passing that bottle of scotch back and forth. And maybe or probably one of them is, in fact, at this point, an otherworldly, horrifying, homicidal alien terror. And they're sort of saying, well, but maybe it's sort of futile to continue this sort of pattern of distrust. And, all right, maybe one of us is an alien. Maybe both of us is an alien. But we can't really do anything about it. I guess we may as well share a drink. And, you know, I mean, I can imagine, you know, I imagine the happy ending after this, where the alien sort of finally speaks up and says, you know, I was just trying to build a ship to get home. I didn't want to do all this. But that's probably not how it ends. Although it does, I mean, it does leave open the question of the logic sketched earlier, right? Which is, okay, well, if one of them is the thing and the other is sort of not particularly well-armed, why doesn't it just attack now? Or maybe it's waiting for the most opportune moment. But anyway, it's just an interesting kind of final scene where, maybe out of kind of nihilistic resignation, but nevertheless, they have both, to some extent, kind of abandoned the paranoia that's been driving the film.
Right. They're no longer paranoid. They're simply weary. But I think they've both resigned themselves to whatever their fate might be. MacReady clearly concluded that no one can leave alive. And so either he'll be the last one alive, at which point presumably he might like off himself, or Childs will be the last one alive. But they both concluded that. I mean, the reason why they're waiting, right, is that all the fire. Childs says, you know, the heat's still elevated from all of this. So we have some time. And so we'll, you know, once everything dies down, then they'll know which of them is the thing, if either of them is. But yeah, I mean, I can the optimistic ending to me, if you want to read it, is just that neither of them are the thing, and they both sort of just like, you know, they die of exposure, and thus the thing doesn't escape. So in the optimistic version, they successfully keep the thing from spreading, but no one survives. But it's that ambiguity, and sort of even that ambiguity gets back to this the idea throughout the film that people are unknowable, sometimes even to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, Carpenter has an interview, and this is obviously extra textual, so at some level, right, who cares? But Carpenter has said that he believes one of them at the end is the thing, but has refused to say which. And, you know, I mean, obviously the setup of it is such that, hey, Child shows up again after being kind of mysteriously absent for a lot of the third act, and so, I mean, I think the viewer is supposed to think, well, we should be wondering whether he's the thing. But I don't know how sure are we MacReady isn't a thing? We haven't seen, right? Wait, there's a cut. We don't see what happens to him after the Blair thing. There's shots earlier where it seems like we get a kind of visual of a thing's eye perspective or something kind of zooming on his room. And we have some reason to think that people might be infected for a while before knowing it. So, right, the film in that final scene kind of biases towards wondering if Childs is the thing, but we don't really have that much certainty that MacReady isn't either.
Right, right. It is based on the text, at least, it's basically unresolvable, right? People have spent decades trying to figure out exactly which of them is the thing, and there's no way to answer it. And I think it's that ambiguity which makes this such a different film than the two films that follow, Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness, which don't have that element, right? They're much more conventional in their structure and in how they end.
I have to compare everything to Wagner because I think it's written into my contract.
Gotta
somewhere.
Play the hits.
But no, I mean, right? It is the kind of thing that, right, that tends to infuriate audiences, right? Like the last scene of The Sopranos, the sort of deliberate ambiguity there that kind of made people a little crazy. But I was thinking actually of Tristan and Isolde, where the iconic Tristan chord is sort of left unresolved all the way until the end. Here, right, the chord is never resolved. You've got this simmering tension that's created all through the film, and Carpenter kind of refuses in the last instance. Even though, right, presumably something is going to happen in the next half hour, right, refuses to give you that resolution, which, of course, right, is the secret to a movie that's going to stick in your head and claw at you, right? I mean, an ending where child grows spider legs and attacks or something, and would be, I guess, right, a cleaner resolution. You go, okay, well, that was it, but you know, you wouldn't spend any time thinking about it later.
Well, it's just like, Blade Runner came out the same day, but the ongoing discussion about Deckard being a replicant and everyone arguing whether or not that's the exact reading, right?
It's interesting that you bring that up, Natalie, because for a while, and I believe Carpenter has pretty much completely debunked this, but it was interesting because for a while there was a lot of assumptions and rumors that there was a lighting or glint in the eye of characters in The Thing who had been assimilated, which is like a huge part of the production of Blade Runner itself, and sort of a controversy that's up in the air of whether you see that glimmer in Deckard's eyes at the very end. And it just is so funny to me that these films came out the same day and that sort
Wild.
Of discussion and rumor happened in both of them, even if one of them was pretty much debunked.
The paradox of this kind of ambiguous ending is that it has to be that the point is that there's no textual answer, but also it only works to the extent that you don't just immediately embrace that there's no textual answer, because the film deliberately doesn't give you that answer, but the film does also want you to try and find that answer, The point of the ambiguous ending is that you then you sort of sit with it and keep trying to digesting the film and working over it, looking for the textual answer that isn't there.
There's this sort of puzzle box thing that fans have that is sort of like imposed onto a film. Because for me, the ending is essentially like it's bringing to a conclusion, but also recapitulating all the themes of the movie. All these questions of nobility and of paranoia and all these things come to a final point with just two people sitting face to face with each other, not knowing ultimately if the other is who they say they are, and returning to the point that they departed, except now our hero, or at least our protagonist, MacCready, has a sense of resignation about the entire situation that he finds himself in. Like, I'm not, you know, it makes sense that people would spend, you know, the better part of three decades trying to determine who is whom. But I think you can, I remember watching the first time and I didn't really care, sort of like the thematic elements of that ending were satisfying enough to me.
Right. I mean, I think part of what makes the kind of cult classic is these sort of brain worm things that get into your head and make you puzzle over it. But certainly I think that's right. That ultimately the point of that ending is that it doesn't matter.
And now for the time in the show where we get to share all of the other things that we've been enjoying with our time. This is Locked In. So Julian, Jamel, what else have you been enjoying with your free time? Books, movies, television, games? What else?
So let's see, novels. I just polished off the last book of Charlie Strauss's Merchant Princes series about, I guess, commerce between parallel worlds. This Invisible Sun was the final one of I guess, nine. And I'm reading actually another book about parallel worlds called The Space Between Worlds. So for whatever reason, parallel universes is a theme in my fiction lately. I've been running a couple of different Call of Cthulhu campaigns, one in person and one sort of over Zoom for some friends on the West Coast. So that's been a lot of fun. And also I've been on a kind of a binge lately of books by Bart Ehrman, who is a New Testament scholar, and writes a lot about the process of the compilation of the New Testament and the Gospels, how they were changed over time by scribes and later editors, and how you can try to sort of reverse engineer the sort of form of the oral traditions that are encapsulated in the Gospels, just as out of historical interest as a non-believer. I find that sort of fascinating. And of course, I should mention my friend Spencer Ackerman's excellent book, Reign of Terror, about the post 9/11 war on terror and how it gave rise to the Trump era.
I am always reading, various works of history. So I'm sort of in the middle of a big biography of Julius Caesar, which I'd read SPQR a few months ago and decided I would just sort of like read more contemporary Roman history. But I think after I finished the Caesar biography and there's an Augustus biography by the same author, I'm going to actually read, OG Roman historians, like Livy and Tacitus and Polybius and the whole gang, just for my own edification. And also because I spend a lot of time reading about the early American Republic, 1770 to 1820, and all those guys were, obsessed with the ancient Roman historians. So to that note, I'm reading, it's kind of a tome, so it's taking me a while, but it's a book called The Age of Federalism about the Federalist Party, its beginnings, its growth, and its downfall during the age of Jefferson and Madison and such. So that's what I'm reading. And then sort of to balance out this high-minded reading, I have been binging trash horror franchises. So,
trash horror is our favorite.
I recently watched all the Friday the 13th movies, which are uniformly bad almost. The one that I like the most is, I feel like, the one that gets the most crap, but it's Jason X, because there's at least a concept there. And I think it's pretty well executed. I had watched the entire Nightmare on Elm Street franchise before then, and those movies I really enjoy. Even the very bad ones, I think, have a lot of merit to them. And the best ones, like Wes Craven's A New Nightmare, are genuine classics. I just finished, I just finished Freddy vs. Jason a couple days ago, which I also like because it at least had a concept. And now I'm on the Halloween series. So I've seen John Carpenter's Halloween several times. And we just watched Halloween 2, and I'm just going to go through by release order, since I know Halloween has like a weird chronology if you go by, timeline order.
For me, I'm also doing some spooky season stuff. So I'm listening to an audiobook right now called The Year of the Witching. It's a really, really good audiobook. I don't know if I'd be listening to it not in Halloween-ish time, but it's set in early 1600s, and it's about like a witch haven that's in the colonies. It's fiction, so it's obviously not real, but I've been enjoying it. And then I hopped on the Squid Game train. I'm kind of sad that I did, it was worth watching, but I felt like I just got peer pressured into it. And then I'm taking a break from my historical fiction reading because I'm running out of books, sadly. So I am turning to what is the next book on my list? Oh, it's Untamed. It's a New York Times bestseller. I think it's Glennon Doyle, wrote it. But it's been on that list for a while, so I'm just now getting around to it. But and then of course I'm going to be watching Dune in the next 24 to 48 hours.
I also will be watching Dune very, very soon. I'm very, very excited to watch that. My spooky season, since we're dropping some of our spooky views, I have been watching and rewatching What We Do in the Shadows. So much fun. I love it. I look forward to the new episodes every week, and it's just, it's a great quick thing to watch that I could pick up at any time. So I love that.
Matt Berry might be the funniest person on television right now.
He is my favorite. And actually, I've been watching another thing that he's in that I think I've talked about on the show before. And I think it was an episode Julian was on, which is I have been watching and reading a lot of The Moomins, which is a Finnish novel series that became a cartoon strip and then a sort of Japanese animated television show. And now there's a CGI series that is produced, I think, by Sky in the UK, et cetera. But it's a family of trolls that live in an idyllic sort of valley and live bohemian lives and go on adventures. But it's very Finnish. So it's, there's moments of great elation and wandering in nature and then sheer terror and chaos that for adults is fine, but for children would be super, super spooky. And Matt Berry actually voices the father figure in that as Moomin Papa. And at one point in the first, I think his first line in the whole series is he yells, "Bats!" Which is just hilarious considering his What We Do in the Shadows character. So that's another thing I've been watching. Also, Over the Garden Wall, which is in my classic October rotation, one of my favorite sort of mini series to watch during the fall season. It just captures that feeling so well, and the music is incredible. I really, really love Over the Garden Wall. And I'm also trying to go back and sort of pick up some, classic things or cult classic things that people have told me I would really enjoy that I never got around to. So, for instance, Netflix is coming out with Sandman very, very soon. So I'm going back, and I've never actually read Sandman. So I want to go through and sort of familiarize myself with the source material before I decide if I want to even give the show a chance.
I just have to say, it is such a – I've read that probably 100 times, and seeing just the trailer for that series, seeing this thing I've been, reading and rereading for 20 years, actually kind of represented this high production value version with real serious actors attached is just absolutely sends chills up my spine. So I envy you this experience.
Thanks for listening. As always, the best way to keep in touch with us and get more Pop and Lock content is to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at the handle at Pop and Lock Pod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock with an E, like the philosopher, Pod. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by me, Landry Ayers, and is co-hosted by Natalie Dowzicki. We're a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.